yet powerful foes. The desperate fighting program amongst high school students. A new legend is about to start.
May the manliest of all men come on down!
Nobody touches his precious Nanako, the sister complex kingpin of steel, Yu Narukami!
It's only natural.
Wage slave in the boonies by day, hero by night, Captain Ressentiment, Yosuke Hanamura!
Everything that bores me has gotta go!
A spunky dragon with deadly legs, the carnivore whose discarded womanhood, Chie Satunaka!
You need to eat more meat!
Please escort me to the ring, my prince! The unconquerable Snow Black, Yukiko Amagi!
I'll finish you in one strike!
Blooming roses and bulging muscles, the blood-curdling beefcake emperor, Kanji Tatsumi!
Deep into realms of romance!
The body of a child, the brain of a genius, the 2000 IQ killjoy detective, Naoto Shirogane!
Is this an army of idiots?
Fight and survive towards the one throne waiting at the end! The P1 Grand Prix, where fierce fights will be fought! The battle begins tonight!
And with that, hello and welcome to a special episode of Platforms and Pitfalls. I'm Rowan.
And I am Blue.
And we're here to talk about Persona 4 Arena and its game design. Rather than talking about five games this month, we're going to really focus on Persona 4 Arena and its enhanced sequel, patch, experience, Ultimax as well. The experience of Persona is very tied to the color yellow, so while listening to this episode, just keep an eye out for yellow things in your environment to get a core idea of the experience and occasionally throw in something blue. But what is Persona 4 Arena and Ultimax? These are games made by Arxis, who do things like Guilty Gear and Blade Blue.
Arc System Works, to be...
Sorry, yes. Let's use real terminology that people will understand. Arc System Works. They make a lot of fighting games that are really interesting.
Colloquially called anime fighters, because they borrow a lot of aesthetics from anime. And in this case, yeah, very, very much so as well.
And so this fighting game is based off the Shin Megami Tensei spin-off Persona 4, in which a bunch of school children are trying to solve a murder. And this game is about the aftermath of that game and them getting embroiled in another mystery that requires them to all fight each other in a tournament, because that's what fighting games do.
Yeah, contrived reasons. The reasons and specifics, they're all plot related, and they are important-ish if you care about the story. And if you care about the story Persona 4, they kind of try to move that forward a bit. But like for the purposes of what we're talking about here today, not so much.
So today we're going to talk for a while about the mechanics and the ideas from Persona 4 adapted into a fighting game. And then we're going to spend some time sort of talking a bit more about the narrative parts of this game and how they are interesting and distinct in this context of being a fighting game.
And just bear with us, because to be completely honest and frank, this is an episode we're indulging in. This is a game we both love very, very dearly.
This is a Christmas present to us.
Yeah, we both love the base game, the Persona 4. I genuinely think it's one of the best RPG experiences out there. And this is a really, you know, when you love a game like that and then you see like, oh, it's being adapted to a fighting game, there's like a 50-50 chance. It's just a mediocre experience. But I genuinely think that Arena and Ultimax add something to the universe that's like special. And that's not easy.
I think these games as fighting games are genuinely incredible
yes.
pieces of work.
Yeah.
And we're accidentally noteworthy, relevant.
We are recording the day after it was announced at the Game Awards that Persona 4 Arena Ultimax will get a PC and like a new console port. So PS4, Switch, and PC, I believe.
And we planned this episode about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, Jeff got in contact with us. He was like, hey, you might want to release this then. We were like, okay.
So yeah, we're going to start our gushing in the next section.
So
So Persona 4 Arena is an adaptation of a 70 to 100 hour turn-based RPG.
Lots of menus.
It has lots of menus.
Yeah. And this is before the time when Smash, you know, put a menu in the game for one character. So menus in fighting games were not really a thing back then. And thank God they're not still really a thing now either. But yeah.
And whenever we talk about any, like, putting one franchise in a different context, this idea of adaption is really, really interesting.
Adaptation, not adaption.
Oh, so adaption, yeah. Adaptation, sorry.
Uh-huh.
This idea of adaptation is really interesting because how do you bring something into a different format? And so one of the interesting things about Persona compared to other fighting games is that the Personas are separate entities that you summon in combat. And they're mapped just to like a regular button press, like any other game might have a heavy attack or something. But they are separate to your character's body. So they can appear in different locations. They can move independently of you to some extent, cover different parts of the screen and so on.
Yeah, like they have preset things, but like once you get good with the character, you know how to manipulate the preset things to get it to do what you want, to be placed where you want them to be placed. If you think of a controller as having, you know, you look in your mind's eye for a controller, you see the four face buttons. Two of them are what we call physical, as in your main character's body, and then two of them are called persona buttons, where they control your persona. And this is just a generalization. This is not necessarily true for every character, but like it's a universal enough thing that it's a functional understanding of how we're mapping this, you know, annoying second component to a character into a controller. And to give context examples to an already niche example, I'll use an even nicher one. The personas act a lot like stands out of JoJo. They kind of just come out of the character's body and then do a thing that is separate. And then they disappear back into the main character's body.
And in fighting games, when you sort of control two characters, this is part of an archetype that we would often call a puppet character. And there are examples of this in everything from Smash Brothers with Ice Climbers and Rosalina. They're famously in a lot of arc system fighting games like Carl from Blay Blue and character from Guilty Gear that has a name.
Eddie and Zato. Yeah, Zato one. So, you know, our arc system works definitely, I think, pushed the 2D version, like the, you know, traditional Street Fighter 2D version of a puppet character the furthest. So giving it to them to make an entire game full of puppet characters, because that's what the roster for Persona 4 Arena is just basically everyone is a puppet character. Solid. Super solid choice. They don't feel the same, right? Like,
yeah, they don't feel the same to both other fighting game characters and even to each other. The ways in which everyone is a puppeteer is very different. So some characters that are very close range in nature with their own abilities, their personas also mirror that. Other characters are close range in their own skill sets, but their personas go far. And so they end up controlling a lot of fighter distance using their persona rather than their skills and so on. And it's really interesting. Personas are really powerful tools, and every character uses them in different ways to control different amounts of space compared to their own body. And this sounds really powerful in a fighting game.
It is honestly a remarkable design challenge because, you know, if you control two characters, just numerically, mathematically speaking, you have more characters than one. And that's a lot. That's not just a silly way to say it, but fighting games are a lot about like the mental stat is a term that I like to use. How much do you have to think about at any given moment to moment in the gameplay? And just adding an extra like character component to think about, that starts to strain it because, you know, a lot of beginner fighting game players, they struggle to even move the way they want. So making them think about two characters, that starts to get challenging.
And while we're saying the phrase two characters, I want to make it clear that when you control a persona, you press the button and it will do a thing and then after a moment go away again. Maybe you can press a button again to make it do another thing, but they're automatically going away and not cluttering the screen all the time. It's not literally controlling two independent fighting game characters.
Yeah, you don't literally need two controllers. So that's really like some of the great design in this, right? They give you the feeling of You have so much power at your disposal. You have this flexibility. You have this persona feeling character on screen without making it like incomprehensible to a new player.
And one of the neat things I think about this system is the limitation on it. So personas are frail. If they get hit, they will vanish. So unlike regular fighting games where if you get hit while doing attack, you are generally more severely hurt. In this, if the persona is hit, your character might be fine, but the persona loses one persona card, which is a resource that's under your life bar. And usually it's sort of between like 2 and I think 7 is the highest, right?
I do not know what specific number is, but that sounds about right. Yeah.
There is a lot of variation in how many cards a character has for their persona. And these work relatively simply. One hit takes away one card. When you run out of cards, you have to refill your cards by waiting. And then once you have them all filled up, you can use your persona again.
It's a fascinating resource to manage because your persona is simultaneously a great source of offense and defense.
And it really changes up the risk reward of a lot of situations. So characters who are generally more reliant on their personas have more cards, but that means that it takes longer for them to get their persona back. So a character that is a lot of fun, Yukiko, she's very reliant on her persona to do a lot of things. And so she has many more cards than maybe some of the more direct melee characters do. And so the thing for the melee characters is they've got to struggle for a while, whittle down that persona. And once they do, they can then go in and they've got a lot of time to try and take out Yukiko as much as they can within the time limit, basically.
And it's scary to be on the defense as a character that's hyper-reliant on personas. So most of the time, if the match goes well for like a character like Yukiko, she will not run out of persona cards in the full match. Like, her goal is to kill before that becomes a problem. Because the flip side to that is, it is potentially round losing to lose persona.
It is. It's a rough time for that girl.
Yeah.
But a character more melee focused like Chia, she has, I think, 2 cards. So she might lose her persona multiple times in a match, but you have to hold out for maybe 2 or 3 seconds before you get it back again. So it's not a significant penalty, although it is still a penalty.
Yeah, for Chie, it's rough. A few of her like interesting mobility options that are risky come from the persona. So she loses a bit of trickiness. I would say a character like Akihiko is like pretty, because I believe he's also a 2. He's pretty just fine without a persona for a few seconds. He can hold his own. He has fast buttons. So, you know, if you're pressuring him and you don't like fully pressure him, he can just jab you in the middle of it and like make you like stutter back. And that might be enough time for him to just get his persona back.
And so this is to say that like this core mechanic of persona is really interestingly implemented in the game. It really changes up the tone of the game as a fighting game. And it really changes the flow of the match in distinctive ways with how these persona cards are used. That is one of the ways that I think really makes this shine. In the next section, I think we'll talk about status effects, which are a very key RPG component.
So Persona 4 as an RPG, how do you get through a fight in an RPG, right? You kill your enemy, you kill the opponent. But it's not always just like damage effects that you want. Sometimes you have to dish out or contend with status effects. That's actually a really interesting component that Arc System Works. I feel like they went out of their way to put RPG, like very traditional RPG status effects, into a fighting game. I don't think many people would have faulted them if they didn't, right?
On one hand, a lot of these are kind of frustrating the first time you run into them, of course. But I do feel that since the Shin Megami Tensei franchise and Persona, compared to other things like Final Fantasy, status effects are so important. Both as a thing that you inflict, but as a thing that gets inflicted on you, like they are devastating. And so to not include them would not feel very Persona-like.
So they did it. The Mad Lads went out and did it. There are 8 like traditional Persona 4 status effects in the game that complement a fighting game extremely well. We won't list them all, I don't think. Like, that's just going to be a list of things, but we can talk about a couple of them. What's one that you really like?
I think the one that like is a strong word. The one that has inflicted the most personal trauma on me, particularly when playing against you, is Shock.
Yeah.
And I think it's sort of a good representation of how extreme these statuses can be. So Shock restricts all normal movement. So pressing left does not move you. Pressing right does not move you. Up no longer jumps.
Yeah, you can crouch and you can hold back to block. Your character just is stuck to the ground. We'll get to some universal mechanics in a bit that like kind of mitigate the effect of this. So this isn't just a death sentence.
You need to use commands to move rather than just normal traditional movement now.
So just like in the game, when you get inflicted with a status effect, you might have to play differently to mitigate it. This in a moment-to-moment frenetic fighting game. That's really cool. That's really, really cool. Another one that I would bring up just as the last example, very quickly, Confuse, because this does actually appear in a lot of other fighting games. I suppose I should say the Persona 4 term for it is Panic, but like a lot of us as like people who play other games would know this is Confuse, where up is down, left is right, you know, vice versa. It just reverses your movement controls for the duration of it.
By having these aspects play such a key role in the game, it again lends it this very distinct vibe. Like, oh, I'm playing against this character. I have to keep in mind that my inputs might get reversed at a certain point.
At any point, yeah.
Oh, like this character can inflict shock. So I need to be really on point with my movement options when I'm shocked so that I can get out of the status effect.
One of the key elements as well to the way status effects in Persona 4 Arena works is if you have been inflicted a status effect, if you have been shocked, if you are able to land any hit, like actually land not a blocked hit on the opponent, you are out of the status effect. The status effect drops from you.
Yes, which really incentivizes you to actually like go for the aggressive, unlike a lot of other games where often status effects are time-based, like, ah.
You just turtle back.
One of these effects is really interesting for that. So there's an effect called Fear, which is that you can't get out of grabs anymore. And that when you get counter hit, you are in a more severe position when you get counter hit.
Yeah, it hurts more. It's bad.
So you don't want to be aggressive when you're in that condition, but you want to get out of that condition because you don't know how long you can maintain perfect play.
It wants to make you afraid.
Yeah, it's real smart, basically.
Okay, it is real smart. However, and this is a mark against Persona 4 Arena, it is complicated. New players do not internalize this.
Yeah, complicated. This will be more in more detail maybe a little later, but yeah, this game is a very interesting relationship between being easy and readable and being obtuse and complicated.
You know, and some of it is obvious enough, like when you're shocked, you can't move. But what Rowan described with Fear, that's not obvious. Oh, my character looks a bit more purple. That's probably bad. I don't think the game like really tells you how bad it is in the moment to moment.
I don't even use like the actual in-game terminology because I was worried about confusing people with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So pluses and minuses. This is a like beautiful and elegant implementation of RPG mechanics into a fighting game, a genre that you would think status effects would break it. And in a lot of ways it does, but it's smart in how it breaks it. You know, it gives you a different mini game basically while you have a status effect on you. The problem is, it's a minigame. And, you know, if you've played Mario Party, if you've played WarioWare, whenever you get any minigame, you need that, like, small moment to practice. You don't get that kind of downtime in a fighting game.
It's a real big barrier in initial learning. If you think about how I think a lot of people really play fighting games, it's less overwhelming because a lot of the time I play a character and you play a character and we play those characters for after we've figured out who we like anyway. We start playing them for an extended set of matches and then change up.
Sure. I don't know. My experience with a lot of like new players and fighters is that they'll just randomly jump between characters because they want to see the variety in the game.
Like, so yeah, very initially it's like a lot of jumping around and then settling down into like two or three.
True. That's one angle. That's one element of our RPG combat mechanics in the fighting game. And that is really like symptomatic. It's like a part of what this game is doing as a broader whole, which is just how do we translate RPG combat into a fighting game? And a lot of it is artistic liberty. right? There's only so much animation that goes into the like combat in an RPG, especially a turn-based, menu-based RPG.
And Persona is also in sort of monster collection space.
Yeah.
While it's only protagonist that is amassing a lot of different demons, as Persona calls them, or personas, your other characters are also like following the same sort of animation principles, which are a lot like Pokemon. You have one model that can do many moves, but they're represented by like three or four animations.
Regardless of what action they did, they strike a pose, right? So strike a pose, fireball. Strike a pose, kick.
Punch
somehow.
Sound effect.
Yeah. Like it works for an RPG. It wouldn't work for a fighting game.
And so one of the really fun things, thinking of this section as like part of adaptation, is taking these abstract implementations of moves and attacks and how people fight and making them a lot more concrete and tangible and like actually fighting. These are sort of somewhat similar to how Pokemon characters in Super Smash Brothers, once they're in that game, their moves now exist. They're not just a series of flashes on the screen anymore. They're animated. They have weight and gravity and space to them that the games don't really tend to represent.
Yeah, when Charizard does Rock Smash in Smash Brothers, he pulls out a rock and smashes it with his head. Unlike in Pokemon, his character sprite jumps up and down a bit and then the rock falls on the opponent or something like that, right? Like, they get the full reality, quote-unquote, of the move across. So, like, what's a good example for Persona here?
There are two characters I really want to talk about for this because they both sort of land on different sides of very RPG and not suited to fighting games and very, very easily converted. So one of them is Chie. She is a martial artist inspired character that also uses like some limited ice magic, but she's not really much of a mage compared to anyone else in the team.
To be clear, she's a dork who likes martial arts movies. She's not a martial artist.
I believe it's a line in Persona 4 that she copies kung fu movies.
Yeah,
specifically.
Yeah, she's a fan of Bruce Lee. Like, one of her win quotes in Persona 4 is "Don't think, feel."
Yep, which represents her as a character very well.
It's great. So, yeah.
A lot of her moves are based on kung fu movies, and so she's doing flips and kicks and cool poses. Her persona will come out and spin around a glaive to hit people with. It's very tangible and very readable as these are martial arts converted into moves. And Chie's striking a lot of cool, fun poses and like really bouncing around in her animation.
Yeah, it's really about the poses.
So you get a great sense of her characters being in that moment, not thinking, feeling, and it's all very direct. But a character that is my favorite, honestly, Naoto, her character idea in the Persona 4 game itself isn't really very tangible to a fighting game. She relies a lot on instant death spells, which if she had any of those in a fighting game, would cause a lot of problems if they work the same as the RPG.
Even her normal attacks, she attacks with a gun. That's not exactly a... There have been like fighting game characters with guns, but it's not as easy as just going, this character has a sword, this character punches people, right? What do you do with a gun? So we'll talk about the insta-kill spells, because they're fascinating the way it's been implemented into Persona 4 Arena.
So in Persona 4, the base game, they aren't very good on a lot of enemies unless they're weak to the element of light or darkness. And then they're very, very effective. So in Persona 4 Arena, basically when you fight against someone as Naoto, they have a counter under their life bar.
I believe it's called the Fate Counter.
Yes, that's right. It's called the Fate Counter. And as Naoto hits with certain attacks, that counter will decrease. She has a number of attacks that do more damage. A lot of the things that do more damage to the Fate Counter are traps, basically. And so Naoto's game plan is to lay a lot of traps on a field to take down this counter to then land one of her instant death spells. And your opponent is aware of what's going on. So they want to avoid all these traps. They want to keep the pressure on so you can't do that. And one of the very interesting things about this process is that, unlike almost every other resource in the game, the fate counters only partially recover between rounds. So you start, I believe, with 13 at the start of a match, a best out of three game. And between every round, you gain half of the difference between what you currently have and the maximum. So if you have zero at the end of a match, you'll go up to seven, I believe.
So this is one of the things that a lot of, again, the term anime fighter gets thrown around a lot. And a lot of it is aesthetic choice, but there's also a lot of mechanical aspects to an anime fighter. One of the things is that in an anime fighter, the developers are very willing to just give characters completely unique mechanics with unique interfaces. So this fate counter doesn't appear between matches with anyone else. It only appears under your life bar if your opponent is Naoto. And it's just a thing you have to know that Naoto is able to do. It's easy to overlook it, but yeah, well, you know, you play the game enough and you just know, I need to worry about how much fate I have left. You can block it, and as Rowan said, you can pressure her. If you hit her at any point, she loses all of her traps. Is that right?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And you can also just attack the traps if you know where they are.
It's a very set up game for a fighting game. It not unusual for Arc System Works. I will, like, important to note here, they didn't invent something completely new for this character. It's a lot of iteration, right? Arc System Works have been playing with unique characters and unique mechanics for characters that you have to learn specially for decades at this point. So culmination, it's such a beautiful culmination of all that knowledge and experience.
And it's a really interesting combination of Naoto as like a character narratively a little bit, not to get too much in detail, but she is, as this game phrases it, the 2000 IQ killjoy detective.
Yeah.
And so playing this like smart game, this long game compared to other characters in the game overall that focus a lot on like creating awkward, complicated situations for your opponents is very in line with her as a character and is represented really well mechanically here. And I think they're really interesting. But with that, I think we should take a break and maybe talk about universal mechanics next.
Sounds good.
Universal mechanics in Persona 4 Arena are a really interesting beast. So universal mechanics in fighting games are really important, as they are in any game, because especially in fighting games, though, every character is so unique and diverse that the universal mechanics in a complicated game really help you have a framework to understand how to play the character. What are my options? Well, I know regardless of who I play, something defensive will happen if I do this. Something offensive will happen if I do that.
Remember what I said about the mental stack? It alleviates some of the pressure from that. You at least know these are the basics. These are the fundamental things that I can do in this game. I at least can do this, even if I can't do the best thing for this character.
And Persona 4 Arena comes out in a time when accessibility in the video game idea of something that people can quickly pick up and approach was the big discussion, especially regarding fighting games.
I think this was in the first 2 years, which saw the beginning of every fighting game for the next 5 years having some weird, like, unique selling point of we're trying to get new players in and we're going to make this game more accessible than it's ever been in the franchise.
Yeah, so this comes after we've had Street Fighter 4 with its ultra meters, after Blade Blue had a big push towards accessibility, even though you looked at it nowadays, you might not realize that was the original point of that game, to be less complicated than Guilty Gear. But this is a really big push for that. And a lot of what Persona 4 Arena tried to do to make itself approachable was to have a lot of universal systems for players to latch onto and know, I can do this. I have an option. And it's very clear and distinct. And how characters use each universal mechanics may be a little different, but they're all here. So I think maybe the most infamous one is the auto combo. So up to this point, Arc System Works has dabbled with having a stylish mode for characters in Blade Blue and things, where the button inputs are simplified so you can get combos by just pressing a button several times.
Yeah, you decide this at character select. You say, I want the stylish version of this character. It's not easy mode, but it is, I don't fully understand what this game is, and I just want to see pretty colors mode.
Yeah, and they work for that, but if you try to play them against humans who are playing traditional input, you are very limited in your options to the point that you're not really playing the same game. So this was one of the first times Arc System Works actually implemented the auto combo as part of the core mechanics of the game.
I was going to say it's in every one of their games from now, but it's not. That's a lie. Scrap that.
Yeah, the newest one is the first one in a while to not have it, though.
Yeah.
But this has become like a big feature of their games for a while going forwards. Anyway, this is a really interesting choice, and I think it's a really successful choice for making this game approachable. You and I typically like teach people fighting games not infrequently. I've probably like seen like one of the things that can be frustrating at fighting games is not knowing what to press when you want to like do something that feels good to do.
What do I do the cool thing? I want to do the cool thing.
Or even just like, I want to do my super. So auto combos, you press the light attack button many times and you will do a fairly simple combo that you can easily outdo if you want to put in any amount of time to do so. But it's fine. Like, it'll work, and it ends with a super if you have the meter to do so.
Otherwise, it terminates in a sensible point with a special. It's a thing. You just go, all right, focus on where you're standing on the screen, and then when you think you're close enough to hit me, just hit that button. Just hit this button as many times as you can. It works. It works.
This is effective enough. So there was sort of a meme very early on in this game's life with one character who had a very good range on her light attack button and also had a very good defensive option. And so someone made a custom arcade stick that only had two buttons, which is all this character would need to play the game, basically.
To be clear, I think as well, for historical reasons, and since this is an indulgent podcast and I'm wasting time explaining why I'm doing this now, this meme controller was made because someone won a tournament, like one of the very early ones, with this character using the strategy of just auto combo and defensive action.
Yes. Yeah. And so that's the next option that we'll talk about then, defensive action.
Furious action is what the game
furious
calls it.
Furious action, sorry. So there are four buttons in the game, light attack, heavy attack, light persona, heavy persona. If you press both heavy buttons, you will do a furious action, which for every character varies quite a bit, but is often invulnerable, a counter of some kind, or anti-air, like a dragon punch from Street Fighter, where a character will do an attack where they're very, very safe and will move up in the air with a large attack hitbox. They're a very good button to press when you panic. Basically,
in summary, so far of what we're talking about with universal mechanics, this is something that every character can do. You have a button that when you want to just attack, you can mindlessly press. You have a button combination that when you think you're in trouble, you can just mindlessly press.
Yeah.
It's very good.
This helps new players so much. Like, even if you don't know what your special moves are, like in Street Fighter, if you forget how to do a dragon punch, you can't play the game.
I don't know how many listeners out there have played fighting games before, but if you have, whether or not you're still at this hump of, give me a second, I'm just gonna, and then you just stand at full screen for like 10 seconds trying to do the move, and then you do it and you whiff completely because you're nowhere near your friend, but you go, yeah, I got it, and then you try to do it in the scramble and you can't, right? So Persona 4 Arena tries to cut out some of that.
And then you've got the evasive maneuver. So we talked about shock earlier. The evasive maneuver is one of the things you can do to move while shocked. If you press both light buttons, you'll do an evasive maneuver. And I think this might be where you start realizing the problem with this accessibility. So we've got mash A to do auto combos, two heavy buttons to do a defensive furious action, two light buttons to do an evasive action, but we're not done. During the evasive action, you are invulnerable outside of the very start and end of the move. So it's a way to get through things that are coming towards you, like projectiles. And this is another like good thing for new players to have access to, because often zoning, a lot of use of projectile moves is one of the things that trips up new players. So having a thing to be like, oh, they're doing this, I can do this.
Try this to go through it.
And, you know, once you get good at the game, you might be timing out. Okay, I'm going to bait them into doing it so then I can hit them. Or, oh, I'm going to punish them for doing this too early or too late with something else. Lots of ways to work around it. And then we have pressing two physical buttons to do our all-out attack, which in fighting game terms is an overhead, which means that when you block, you can either block high or low. You have to block it high. And it can lead into very devastating combos.
An extended combo. Yeah, an extended combo.
If you crouch while doing that, you can do a sweep. If you press both persona buttons, you can throw. And this means that basically every pair of buttons that are next to each other, so not opposite pairs, but just next to each other, does a thing. And now we've gone from having a universal set of inputs that are supposed to make things accessible, that now just make things confusing for a lot of people.
Yeah, I remember that mental sack.
Ultimately, it works.
Yeah, it mostly works because you do tell your friend who's starting to play this, mash this button to attack me. If I'm attacking you and you want to get out and you don't want to deal with it, push these two buttons, right? And like, you know, you slowly ramp it up from there. But holy moly, there's a lot of things to, it's like doing homework.
And you have to go through the tutorial really to work out what's going on, and fighting game tutorials are still very homeworky.
It took 20 minutes for us who know how to play fighting games to get through the tutorial.
Yeah. And yeah, these are all like very smart things, but they do help. Like Persona 4, for all its complexity, does give people options that are very clear on why they're useful, which is something a lot of fighting game universal mechanics aren't so clear on.
Yeah.
These things all have a very distinct purpose that is, once you see it, intuitively useful, I think.
Okay, so that leads to a good point. We're talking about universal mechanics from the perspective of accessibility and new players. Let's talk about universal mechanics from the perspective of adding depth to a game. You touched on some of this. Like, once you know what your opponent's going to likely do, you can start to like predict it and then punish it, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is all super important. Knowing that every character has a panic button that can kind of get them out of any situation. What do you do against that? Well, you let them push the panic button and then you hit them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the game rewards you for that. You get a like more powerful, more damaging hit off of doing something like that. What are the purposes of auto combo at high level gameplay? Well, auto combos, although they don't deal as much damage as if you know a good combo, they build you more meter than a lot of base combos will do for you. So if you don't terminate in the super, you can get resource to make the match go better. So you can like pick and choose where these universal mechanics go. And I think that's like one of the challenges of this kind of game design. You can make a game super easy to play, but you don't want to make a game have no longevity and depth, especially a fighting game. There isn't much variety in a fighting game outside of what can my opponent do and what can I do to my opponent? What are the interesting ways we can Tetris together my options against theirs? So that's part of why the universal mechanics are so complicated, because these devs are fun. I don't know how else to like kind of say it. These devs are fun, want to have fun, and they put mechanics in a game that they think are fun in a way that makes sense.
The big appeal of Arc System Works fighting games, I think, is that they are not safe games. They are willing to throw complicated things onto characters that you have to learn and that are complicated enough to be learned rather than just be seen and understood.
Naoto can just kill you from any point, but...
Not from any point.
But that's what I mean, like... There's, but you have to do this.
Yeah.
Chie can have like the most powerful super in the game, but you have to do this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Kanji can stop you just moving, literally.
Mm-hmm. But then there's this counterplay. Yeah. And then there's this counterplay on the other side of it. So that's a lot of it. That's a lot of, you know, the past 30 plus minutes that we've been talking. It's a lot of like what makes Persona 4 Arena and Ultimax so gosh darn interesting from a mechanical point of view.
And I think with that, it's time to turn to, I think, the other interesting thing about this game, which is its narrative component.
All right. So we've talked through a lot of, you know, the mechanical components of how you take an RPG into a fighting game. Now, that is not the most horrible thing to do. Like, that's a fun exercise, right? Oh, what if you could just punch the opponent? Now we get to something that fighting games are traditionally very weak at, which is storytelling. I don't think it's really a secret to say that fighting games don't tell good stories a lot of time.
I want to be defensive here and be like, okay, fighting games don't tell like good stories like directly, but there's a lot of good storytelling in like character costuming, in the small art style.
They don't tell good word story. For sure.
I don't tell good plots, but they can communicate a lot of story and do a lot of good storytelling in interesting ways. Sorry.
No, you're absolutely right. Very good point. However, does still come down to it that Persona 4 is a very plot-heavy game, plot-heavy story. It is character-driven, and as in, like, and internal. It's a very internal struggle kind of game.
A lot of people's first impressions of this game are the sort of 2 hours of more or less being shipped conversation to conversation before you even encounter anything supernatural.
The first time you can walk is 40 minutes into the 40 minutes into the game, and you literally walk down a corridor and then you get to the next cutscene, right? So how do you take that and put it into a fighting game? Well, Persona 4 Arena gives you a visual novel, effectively. It puts visual novel components between each fight. This isn't perfect, but this is effectively how all the conversation dialogues occur in the base game anyway, right?
And this is also a technique that Arc System Works have been doing in their previous game, Blay Blue. I've been telling quite an involved story through it. So this is a method in which this company were experienced in telling a story in by this point.
And it probably has to do with some bias from us. And to be completely honest, some video game language literacy, right? The more you play these kinds of games, the more you fall into the rhythm of extracting story and information from it. And to be completely honest, I think it works. I think it's fine. I don't think it breaks the mold. I think this is a very expected outcome of how do we tell a new and interesting story, because Persona 4 Arena doesn't just rehash. It's not like Dream Match scenario. It is a brand new story that takes place 6 months after the events of the base game, and it wants to, you know, deliver this story and give you a good fighting game, and it's not an RPG. You don't get to run around and make decisions and level up and that kind of stuff.
But this is a canonical story in this universe that a lot of things in the expanded Persona 4 realm do touch on events that happen in this and so on.
So, what do they do that is cool? Well, it is a fighting game story mode, which means that you are basically going through dialogue to get from fight A to fight B, but you can still have flavor in the sections. So, well, first of all, the main character is given a canonical name, because in the Persona 4 games, you get to name your main character. In Arena, instead of allowing you to do that, the main protagonist character is named Yu Narukami. So for disambiguity's sake, we will refer to him as Narukami. Narukami gets a decent amount of choices, like dialogue choices in his story mode. Most of them are flavor and don't matter, right?
Which reflects the game itself in a lot of ways. Most choices you make in the game are just a chance for you to roleplay a little bit and maybe change your relationship points with some characters.
Yeah. So you'll have to take my word for it, because I don't really have a good way of describing it. While playing it, it made me feel like Narukami is still special. You know, it made it feel like he had a bit of agency in this, in the story mode, even though he really doesn't. So illusion of choice is important.
It also changes like the pace a little bit, like having these moments where you make a choice, taking a break from that constant stream of text does change the feeling, the pacing of his story mode a little bit compared to everyone else's story modes. And it feels more like the game itself. Because the game often presents you with like small little choices that ultimately don't matter. And so it keeps it feeling like you are playing a Persona game in his story mode specifically.
Yeah. And I think the writers and localization team did a really good job, because when you are in Narukami's sections, you feel at home if you've played Persona 4 Arena, Persona 4 base game. But what is super cool is we get to see a lot of story mode that takes place from the perspective of other characters, of like what they're going through, what they're doing. And we don't super often get to sit inside Yukiko's head or Chie's head. We always experience their trouble, their strife, their internal, you know, mess that we all are through the perspective of main character Narukami and how he is able to empathize with them. So in Arena, we get to see Chie being a goofball in her own room for a bit. I appreciate that. Like, that's cool.
We get to see her room.
We get to see her room. Yeah, precisely. We get to see her room.
In this story mode, there's a lot of, like, unique art that is not shown in the games. It's like, we get to see, like, every character's bedroom and apartment or, like, their family's apartment, and a lot of little tiny ways to build up these characters if you weren't already familiar with them from Persona 4, the base game.
Mm.
And in fact, one of the small issues I have with this whole story mode is that it's written both for people who've played the game before and who are fresh to it.
Yeah.
Which leads to a lot of endless repeating of information, because you can choose any of the main Persona 4 team characters as the initial player. Like, You can choose many story modes, and the game won't check if you've played any of the others for a little while. Like, there is cutoffs that you need to play. So, sorry, I'm getting into the weeds. My point is, there's a lot of, like, reiterating of information.
You will be told from multiple people's perspective that they haven't seen Narukami in 6 months.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, like, that kind of thing, right? Like,
and you'll also be told that, oh, last year we all did a Scooby-Doo gang adventure.
And then Yosuke will say, that sure was a rough time. And, you know, like, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And that's all fine. That's just...
Yeah. It's an unfortunate consequence of, like, the structure, but it's a very wordy story. Like, all of the story modes in the first Persona 4 Arena, I think, are supposed to be between 20 to 30 hours of visual novel reading.
But Jesus, seriously?
Wow. Yeah, it's a lot. Like, each of these characters has about an hour, hour and a half of story mode.
Credit to them, it flew by for me.
I'm glad it flew by for you.
Yeah, it really did. I the way I experienced this... is the way I would describe experiencing this was like catching up with old friends. I'm sure that I'm not alone in this. I get like super nostalgic for characters that you grow attached and bonded to in an RPG sense. And it's very rare to see what happens in the happily ever after, because a lot of these games don't really have a happily ever after. They're teenagers. They go back to their lives. Well, what are their lives looking like? Hey, here's a game that takes place 6 months after. It's gonna put them into a hot pot of water again. But just before that, we get a glimpse of what they're up to. That's super cozy for me. And that's a really good place that I'm not sure many sequels really hit. A lot of sequels like to jump into something straight away, but this isn't a spiritual sequel. This is a plotical sequel. I don't know how to.
Yeah, this is a canonical sequel.
Yeah, it's a canonical sequel. That's the word. Absolutely. Because this is a canonical sequel, like, we get in a different mechanical game, right? We get to just go back into the minds of these characters. And that's rare, in my opinion. And that's really cool. So it's definitely something that's special.
One of the cool things I think about this is that a lot of spin-off fighting games don't really let anyone have an arc. Like, they've got to be the characters you know and love. Their story beats are resolved. There's nothing more for them to go through. So what do?
A lot of spin-off fighting games are dream match scenarios where it's not canonical and therefore no stakes exist, right? Like, when you really drill down to it, nothing can change here. So we can't really put any characterization in peril.
But there's one character in the sequel particularly that you really got an arc, even between Persona 4 Arena and Persona 4 Ultimax, the sequel to this fighting game.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great segue.
Not a great segue if you say it.
No, credit where credit's due. So the character Rise Kujikawa is the support character in the base game Persona 4 Arena. She's what the team calls a navigator. And what these characters do is they talk at you. Like, her voice is just, hey, look out, that enemy has fire attacks. Oh, would you look at that? That enemy is weak to ice attacks. She does that.
They're the voice in your head.
Yeah, they're the voice in your scouter, hopefully, not in your head. And she's fine in the base game. She comes in a bit late, so she's not exactly like the heart of the team, you know? She's there. She's a valuable member by the end, for sure. She struggles. She goes through the turmoil, but she's not a frontline character. And like, if you do her social link, you get a feel for the character. But what they did in Arena is, because it's a canonical sequel, they were able to move a lot of characters forward. And I really particularly like what they eventually did with Rise. Because in Arena, Rise is not a playable character. She's a damsel. She gets kidnapped. That's her purpose. It's very sad. However, in between the events of Arena and Ultimax, Rise goes, that sucked. I still had to be saved. I thought I had grown. You know what? We went through hell and I thought I had grown. But at the end of it, I still needed to be saved. That sucks. So the start of her story mode in Ultimax is her coming to terms with that. If you know anything about the Persona games, know that all the main characters start with an introspective battle. There is something about them that they cannot accept, that they do not like, that they are not happy with. It is some kind of like, you know, like, we're at some point or other in our lives, we want to change. And in very anime JRPG senses, we dramatize the heck out of it. So Rise, if you're familiar with Persona terms, pulls out her shadow self again, faces herself again, but this time the result of it is she goes, I'm not content with just being a support character.
I want to be able to save my friends as well. That's an arc. That's a great arc.
And it's really cool. It's one of those arcs that really works in this like long form meta context. Like,
yeah,
you could just have her have that arc in any story like that, and that would be it. But in Persona, like in Persona 3, you've got a navigator character that never fought either. For the whole of Persona 4, she was a navigator character. She was fine. She spent a whole fighting game story mode being like that. And now we have this change in feelings. We know the format of how personas come to be, and she goes through that process again, and it's...
Her persona changes, which I didn't notice the change from her base game form. You can play her in, like, versus mode first, and I did, and, like, her persona is actually a different persona from the one in the base. I didn't notice that. And she has a great cap-off to this small arc as well. Sorry, you were saying?
Oh, well, I mean, you wouldn't recognize it because you never see her in battle using the persona.
That's a good point. You know, that's a very good point. Yeah, like, whoever notices that. But yeah, her persona gets like a more battle form version. And this arc actually has a great capstone to it as we get into the main story for Ultimax. This all takes place in like her opening story section, right? And then we get to like her like actually joining the fray in Ultimax as a like playable character who is a force in the whatever story is happening, who's making moves and happening. The first thing she does is she storms the school and frees other people who've been held captive. And one of the people she frees is Fuka, the navigator from Persona 3, who doesn't have this same arc, who is content with her role. Like, she says something along the lines of, great, I'm going to help you. I'm used to this. I know exactly what to do. Fuka is comfortable in the navigator role. She doesn't begrudge the fact that she had to be saved because she knows her strengths are as a navigator, and she brings a lot to the team that way. So we get to see both sides of this coin, which is beautiful story writing, in my opinion. That's so good.
It is. I need to sit down and really experience this plot thread for myself, because I haven't played much of the story in the Ultimax version specifically, but every time I hear you talk about it, it does sound really neat, as you say.
Hopefully I'm not like over remembering, because it's entirely possible. Rose tinted glasses, right? But that's definitely the feeling I got out of that. And at the very least, that's a really, really good feeling to get out of a story mode, to feel like a character has moved forward. At the very least, yeah, a character has moved forward. And that's not a thing that always happens in spin-off games, which this is a spin-off game. You know, even though it's a canonical sequel, it is a spin-off game. I think the section has gone a bit long in the tooth. I think we should take a break, and then we'll come back. Okay, so we're back, and we ended on something that kind of just glossed over, which is that Rise saves the navigator from Persona 3, Fuka. One of the things that is really, really cool about this canonical spin-off sequel, Persona 4 Arena Ultimax, is not only does it give us 6 months after the events of Persona 4 and catching up with the, in the community, lovingly calling them the Scooby Gang, they are the investigation team from Persona 4, we also get to catch up with the Persona 3 cast 10 years after their game. They play a pretty major role in this game. The kids in Persona 3 are the adults in Persona 4 in Ultimax.
They are the adults. They know what's going on to some extent. They have a lot more agency, like everyone else in Persona 4 is falling into this story, more or less.
Yeah, but the Persona 3 characters, they barge in and...
And it really feels like they do barge in from like their outfits. They are the characters that aren't wearing school uniforms, unlike the majority of the core cast. Their outfits are very over the top compared to the core cast. Like, they feel like they are not of this world. Not in like their art styles clash, but just they are not one of the Persona 4 kids.
Yeah, they're not kids anymore. Mitsuru Kirijo, who is this prim and proper young lady, right? Like, I think that's a great adjective for her in Persona 3, young lady. She is a tour de force of a character in Persona 4 Arena Ultimax. One of her, like, round start entrances is rocking up in a stretch limo longer than the stage, that you can see on the stage. It's so good. The Persona 3 characters are, they initially barge in, and then a lot of the other casts are kind of like pulled in Ultimax because of this interference. And it's super great to see, think back to when you first saw your Marvel movie crossover, right? It's that.
And it's also in the context of just high school storytelling, which is the genre that Persona 4 and 3 are in, It's very rare to see people who are more than 20 years old.
Who are on their path in life.
Yeah, like everyone in the Persona 3 cast has progressed in life. They have jobs, they're studying, they're professional athletes in the case of one.
And they make really tangible, believable, wholesome relationships between the Persona 3 and 4 cast. Fuka and Rise bond over being navigators. They take different directions out of it, right? They arrive at different conclusions about the role, but that's a shared commonality for them. And that's really great to see them bond over that.
They bond, they learn from their experienced mentors in some cases too. It's a relationship.
Chie sees the musclehead Akihiko and immediately
calls him master.
Yeah, she imprints on him. That's the word I was looking for. She, like a baby duckling, imprints on him. Super great. I absolutely adore. They didn't need to do this, right? Like going way, way, way back to the conceptualization of a spin-off canonical sequel fighting game to Persona 4. They didn't need to do this. Someone did this. Someone pushed for this because they really wanted to see. This is fan fiction level of like dreams come true in the best way possible. Fan service. If there was a point in time where people were like, oh, it's fan servicey. If we haven't come out of that as a like cultural zeitgeist yet, we really need to. Fan service is amazing. Bad fan service sucks. But fan service, when done well, when we get to see things that can only happen in our imaginations, when we can see people interacting in ways that we can't really like, you know, tangibly feel out until it happens in front of our eyes, that's amazing. Super, super great. And just wanted to like kind of touch on the Persona 3 cast and how they interact with the Persona 4 cast.
Yeah. And like we sort of say, this game could have just been the Persona 4 kids.
Easy.
And it probably would have sold exactly as well. It would have appealed to more or less exactly the same audience. It could have been great for Arc System Works, other than like having maybe not quite enough characters. That would be the only real struggle they had. But on top of some Persona 3 characters in this, they also added a new original character. Well, two actually by the end, but in the original Persona 4 Arena release, they added one original character and gave her a really in-depth story mode. So we got a new character called Labrys. Labrys is sort of one of the key parts that a lot of the story revolves around.
Just because I know I am like this, and I struggle to be like, how do you spell it? Labrys. Just for anyone out there who, if that helps.
Yeah. So Labrys is a character that a lot of the story revolves around. She's in what the game calls the TV world.
She's mysterious.
Yeah, she's mysterious. She somehow like believes she's the student council president of this bizarre, otherworldly school that doesn't seem to have any students in it. Something's amiss. And you spend a lot of time. So to unlock this story mode, you have to play a bunch of the other character story modes, but eventually you play her story.
She feels like the antagonist, right? When you first see her, you're like, she has to be the bad guy.
Yeah, except she's also very immediately endearing. So you're very quickly thrown off that idea.
She is coded, like story coded to be not bad guy, but like no one else could be at that point in the story.
Mm.
You know, like the characters approach her as if she has to have something to do with it, and she does. She does have something to do with it. So your brain goes, she has to be in on this. Oh, potentially spoilers, I guess.
Oh yeah, this is super major spoilers. If you have an interest in a Persona 4 Arena, like you want to buy the PC port that's coming out March next year.
And experience it firsthand for yourself, yeah.
Stop listening. We'll have time codes, but after this, it's a lot of our key discussions sort of done, I guess. So yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Let's skip towards the ending notes if you want to experience the story fresh. So, but before we get into the actual narrative beats, let's just talk about this structurally a little bit.
Yeah.
So in every story mode so far, we've either had stories like Narukami's, where you have lots of meaningless choices, or we have the other character story modes where you have one option before a joke ending.
Yeah.
Labrys' story mode is about 1.5 to 2 hours, depending on how fast you read.
Yep.
And there's a single battle. It's literally one battle. And that battle happens at the end of the story mode. But the story itself revolves around fighting. And it's the only story mode in which a fight is implied that you do not participate in. And this is really interesting. And to delve more, now we're going to get into the absolute definite spoilers territory.
Yeah.
So Labrys' story mode is a fairly, in some sense, a fairly standard sci-fi story of a robot being mistreated for the purposes of research.
Yep.
A research institution wants to make a robot that can have a persona. Personas are awakened in either times of facing oneself or under great stress. So they basically create like a psychological...
fake personalities in all of these robots and then get them to kill each other.
And then make them download the memories of their murdered brethren into themselves.
Yeah, imprint on them that they're effectively sisters.
Yep.
And then make them kill each other.
And it's really... this would have been so easy to do in the format every other episode had been done in, which was you would just fight like varying versions of yourself. Maybe each one would have like a little gimmick, like a unique special move or something.
Even just color swaps would have been fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Like color swaps and then like some status effects. You could have done a lot with this, but they don't. And I think this is really powerful because a large part of this story is about the lack of agency that Labrys has.
Yeah.
And in a lot of the story, she doesn't even have a name. She is Unit 31.
Mm-hmm.
And she, a lot of it is her developing an identity, developing an emotional attachment to one of the other units.
Yeah.
And slowly gaining agency until she decides on what she wants to do and escapes or attempts to escape her situation.
Yeah.
It's well written. It's some of Atlas's best localization work. It's mm-hmm. great voice acting, really strong use of like the persona themes and music. It really knocks it out of the park for what
this story mode, like if anything else were you were like, oh, it's a spin-off game, this story mode cements it as a persona game.
Yeah. And I think it's also interesting in that context matters. So yeah, in every other game you had choices, you had battles. The lack of battles, I replayed this like just a day or two ago, so I wanted to make sure I wasn't looking at this with rose-tinted glasses or anything. And I probably still am a little bit because of the first time I played it, but like that like lack of battles really throws you off. So it really threw me off, even though I knew it. Like I was expecting it. I was waiting for it. Seeing these battles described rather than participated in is really powerful in a fighting game.
You know, sometimes you have a memory of an experience you have and you can remember weird details about it. I remember being, you know, in the living room kind of area for the house, the share house I was staying in. I remember it being the afternoon. I remember the way the sun was kind of shining in. I remember leaning forward because you expect a battle to start at some point and then it just never starts. And after like 20 minutes, you just start to lean back in the chair. In the sofa. Like, I remember all of this so vividly because the story mode evokes such like great emotional reaction out of me, at least. I don't know, like, you know, in general, right? Like, yeah.
That music comment's really great. So a lot of, before you actually start any of the fights in the story modes, usually the game will like start a battle theme, like right before you're going to have the battle, more or less.
Yeah.
And a lot of the fight description scenes early on use the battle music from...
it's been priming you. Yeah.
So it's priming you for that exact feeling that you had.
Yeah.
It's really well made. And so Arxis had been doing more and more storytelling through Blade Blue, and the series they would launch after the third reinvention of Guilty Gear, fourth reinvention technically, Exerd,
mm-hmm.
it features more or less just one long movie of storytelling.
It's like 3 hours long, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that this story mode was one of the key things that put Arxis on this path of, we have confidence that people who want to know about this world will read it, that we can tell this story that we want to tell. And if they want to fight, they can press the save button and
go to arcade mode. Yeah.
The game keeps prompting you to save a bookmark like every 10, 15 minutes or so. So like the opportunity to leave and do something else is there for you.
You know how sometimes you start a movie and you're thinking about starting a movie and you're like, I don't know if I have like 3 hours for this, 2 hours for this movie or whatever, right?
Mm.
They're trying to like get rid of that barrier. It's still intimidating. Don't get me wrong.
I mean, I think it's not so intimidating to start with in this because every other story mode apart from Yuse is fairly short.
Oh, no, it's not intimidating in the Persona 4 one, but it was intimidating in Guilty Gear XR.
Oh, in Guilty Gear, yes.
Yeah. No, I think it really works in the Labrys context because nothing implies it's going to be this monstrosity of a gut punch, right? And it just kind of happens to you. And I think that's it's sometimes you want the signposting and it's important for that signposting, but like sometimes you also get like the best reactions out of walking into something blind.
Yeah, and we've ruined that for you, but
maybe you stopped and went away and then came back.
Yeah, but you know, you'll probably still in like this is still like a well written, really good short sci-fi story. It's not like revolutionary by any means, but
no, nothing in this game is that revolutionary other than what if every character is puppet character, right? But you know, it's one of those masterclasses of people were passionate about this game. I see this game and I see passion. These people who made this game, they were fans. They are fans of the Persona series of at least 3 and 4. They put so much into this game and it's so gratifying as a fan to find it, to sift through it. So yeah.
Yeah. So if you listen through all that and you have the chance to play through this story mode, we highly recommend you actually do give the Persona 4 Arena story a go.
You'll have more opportunity than ever in a few months, right?
In March.
And a peek behind the curtains, this story mode, this section, Labrys, is the reason, like, we both love this game, but this is the one that really tipped us over to wanting to do this.
Yeah, like, Persona 4 Arena is one of our favorite fighting games, but if it was just favorite fighting game, we would be talking about Melty Blood today, probably, right?
Yeah.
Like, easily. It is the combination of, like, these really strong mechanical components, this attempt to both be easy for a beginner to uptake, and I mean, getting ahead of myself into the ending thoughts, but let's just do this now anyway, since we're here.
Yeah.
So, like, this fighting game really is something special. It's this combination of narrative things. It's this combination of really unique and outlandish goals of trying to get an RPG to feel like the source material, but in a fighting game with unique character designs, mechanics, and using a lot of universal mechanics to try and help people come to terms with the huge amounts of complexity that they're wading into.
Yeah.
And playing it in prep for this show was just so nice. It is really just such a good Arxis fighting game, and it's really one of my favorites, and I'm so excited for it to come out again in March.
I was so spoiled. This is my first Arc System Works game, and unabashedly, no other Arc System Works game has stood up to the impressions I got from this game.
Yeah,
which is unfair, because Arc System Works does really good games.
Oh yeah, they do amazing work. Like, it's even their worst works are pretty good.
So, like, more context, because we've been doing context for like 3 minutes now. Context. The Game Awards was yesterday from recording, and Guilty Gear Strive, their latest game, won Best Fighting Game of the Year. To be fair, not an amazing competition this year, but really, Guilty Gear Strive is a really, really good game.
Yeah, it's a really good game.
Does not stand up to my impressions of Persona 4 Arena by like a good country mile.
Mm.
And it's just because this game, Persona 4 Arena, some games hit you at the right time, in the right context, with the right background, with the right framing. This is one of those games.
And now that we've done our impassioned finishing speech, we had sort of thought maybe that we would have like just a little bit of raw gushing on like short little statements of just like things that are really cool in this.
And honestly, with that was the point. That was why we did this, Labrys. We've done it. I think we hit everything we wanted to say about this. So
yeah. With that, thank you for listening to us all throughout 2021. If you want to share your thoughts on Persona 4 Arena or with any of the ideas we covered today, you should tweet at the show at Platin Pit. We always love talking about Persona and specifically Arena. You can also find our personal Twitter accounts in the show notes, and you can also find a Facebook page and email. As always, if you enjoyed the show, why not recommend it to a friend? Or if you're feeling particularly fancy, review it. I really enjoyed doing the show in 2021. We did a lot of really fun, interesting topics. I hope
we did a weird start. That was this year, right? In retrospection now.
We did a lot of loop stuff this year. Like, early on, we were doing things like Hades and Chirin.
Was this year not the one with the meta topics?
The meta topics was like
last year? Holy crap. Don't mind me. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
So, on that note, let's talk about what we're doing next year. Episode for next year is looking at avoiding fall damage. And we're going to look at how Just Cause 2, Breath of the Wild, Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild even, Risk of Rain 2, Dark Souls, and Dungeons & Dragons compare in how they let players avoid taking damage from falling from heights.
I have a minor spoiler. None of these games are don't have fall damage. Like, none of these games don't have fall damage. All of these games have fall damage.
Yes.
because that would be the ultimate way to avoid fall damage in a video game. Just not code it in.
You know what doesn't have fall damage? Persona 4 Arena.
That's very true. My emotions hurt when it falls, though, sometimes.
And with us falling from grace so severely, we will see you next month.
Thank you for listening, everyone.